I believe a reasonable person looking at these facts could conclude that all three elements of the crime of obstruction of justice have been met. And I'd like to ask you, the reason again that you did not indict Donald Trump is because of OLC opinion stating that you cannot indict a sitting president, correct?
That is correct.
California Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu's exchange with former special counsel Robert Mueller during yesterday's House Judiciary Committee hearing. It was a rare moment in the seven-hour hearings when Mueller appeared to make news, but then he walked that back. Here now to talk about this exchange is Congressman Ted Lieu. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Congressman, during the second hearing yesterday in the afternoon before the House Intelligence Committee, Mueller made the point of correcting the portion of your questioning we just heard. Let's hear that.
Now, before we go to questions, I want to add one correction to my testimony this morning. I want to go back to one thing that was said this morning by Mr. Lieu, who said, and I quote, "You didn't charge the president because of the OLC opinion." That is not the correct way to say it. As we say in the report, and as I said at the opening, we did not reach a determination as to whether the president committed a crime.
All right, Congressman, what is your response to that?
I thought what Special Counsel Mueller did in Intel Committee was somewhat odd, because if you look at what happened right after my questioning, a Republican member asked him several times to walk that back, and he did not. So I don't know if something happened in the recess, if he got a call from the Department of Justice or someone told him he had to say that. But he clearly understood my question, and he clearly had numerous times to walk that back during the Judiciary Committee hearing.
But he also said to another congressman, a Republican congressman yesterday, "We made a decision not to decide whether to prosecute or not." So he did seem to say that other part repeatedly as well. And in the report itself, he says it would be unfair to indict because Trump wouldn't really be able to defend himself in court during his presidency. So it seems that there are other concerns besides the OLC opinion, concerns about fairness, for example, that he cited in the report for saying that he wouldn't indict the president.
He did say that. On the other hand, what preceded my questioning of the OLC opinion was that I walked Robert Mueller through the three elements of obstruction of justice. He said yes to the first two elements, and then I read straight from his report on the third element, which was intent, and the report says there was, quote, substantial evidence, unquote, to meet that third element. So that essentially established a crime of obstruction of justice, and then I led him to the OLC opinion. So it all flowed logically and made sense. It's like Robert Mueller saying, here, you know, 2 + 2 is, and we keep saying, well, it's 4. And he goes, well, I'm not going to say it's 4, but 2 + 2 is 4. So however you want to call it, he basically laid out all their elements, and they meet the test for obstruction of justice. So that's what happened yesterday.
Well, were you frustrated by this back and forth, that it was not clear, that most people saw that and they didn't really know what to make of it?
Well, it is a nuance. What is clear is that the OLC opinion says you cannot indict a sitting president. And it's not even Democrats that bring that up. It's actually Robert Mueller himself that consistently brings up that opinion and talks about it. And it's very clear that the Department of Justice policy is you cannot indict a sitting president. What the report also says is, since we can't do that, we're going to lay out all this evidence, and then here you, Congress, you are the institution that's responsible for making sure that no one is above the law.
Mm-hmm. But are you frustrated that he didn't actually say 4 in his report or in his testimony yesterday clearly enough, that he didn't say, look, were it not for the OLC opinion, we would recommend indicting?
So I'm not frustrated, because I wasn't, in fact, actually expecting him to actually say that. I was expecting him to stick to the report. And to me, that was what we wanted to get at, was the actual report, because it's so damning. I mean, the report lays out 10 instances of obstruction of justice. And for 5 of them, it's very clear that there's substantial evidence to meet every element of that felony. That's why over 1,000 former federal prosecutors signed a letter saying that any ordinary American faced with this evidence would have been indicted on multiple felony charges.
Okay, so I guess the question now is, the next day, what now? What does Congress do with this?
So the two hearings with Special Counsel Robert Mueller yesterday established three things. One, that the Russians engaged in a systematic and sweeping attack on American elections in 2016. Second, that the Trump campaign embraced it, gave them internal polling data, wanted it to happen, and knew it was going to help Trump. And third, that the president engaged in at least five instances of obstruction of justice, which is a felony, to try to stop that investigation. Now, what members of Congress and the American people do with those facts, we'll see in the next few days, the next few weeks.
Well, what do you want to happen?
Earlier this year, I said that we should start an impeachment inquiry. And so we'll see how other members react.
Well, we've seen how other members have reacted. And Congressman Adam Schiff, for example, today is saying, well, I don't think we should go down this road. I think we should go down the election road, like vote him out of office. He said he thinks that would be more effective if we spent our time, our being Democrats' time, focusing on that rather than impeachment.
So we have a very diverse caucus with people with different views, and people are going to disagree. At the end of the day, Speaker Pelosi will make a decision in consultation with the caucus, and whatever that decision is, I'm going to respect.
So how do you think, just all told, the day went for you yesterday? You did mention the three things that came out of it. But in general, you have the other side, most notably President Trump, saying the Democrats lost so big yesterday. He called it a devastating day for the party. And in general, most people are saying not a lot of new light was shed in the hearing, in the 7 hours yesterday. So are you happy with the way things turned out, or do you wish they had turned out differently?
I would have liked if Robert Mueller was more talkative, but for the days leading up to the hearing, I and other Democrats consistently said that we're not trying to get Robert Mueller to say anything sensational. We just want him to talk about the report, because the report itself is so damning. So for people who know about the report, for press people, for folks who have been following it, none of what he said should have been surprising. The whole point of the hearing was for the overwhelming majority of Americans who have not read the report and only gotten their information from Donald Trump or Bill Barr. If they were watching this with the volume on, they should have been very surprised, because Robert Mueller directly contradicts Donald Trump numerous times. And he said yes and true to a large number of devastating facts to the president.
So you think that this will be good for you, for your party, going forward for 2020?
I do. If you were watching this hearing with the volume on and you heard him say yes and true to this series of devastating facts, you can't come away thinking anything other than that we have a criminal in the White House.
California Congressman Democrat Ted Lieu, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Here's what Mueller did want to talk about yesterday: election security and Russian interference.
Oh, it wasn't a single attempt. They're doing it as we sit here, and they expect to do it during the next campaign.
But it doesn't appear there's much appetite to take protective measures. Today, Senate Republicans killed a couple of bills aimed at strengthening election security. And let's talk more about that with Tim Starks. He writes about cybersecurity for Politico. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, tell us about these bills that were killed.
Yeah, so there was three different bills. Actually, there's two different bills today and three different bills yesterday. The two bills today, one of them would have said that if you're a campaign and you're contacted by a foreign government with offers of assistance, be it financial or otherwise, you have to report that to the FBI and other government agencies. The other one was a bill that passed out of the House recently that was more sweeping and not so micro-focused. The idea of that bill was to mandate paper ballots, to mandate post-election audits. These are considered two of the major things you can do to improve the security of elections going forward. And both of those bills were rejected by the Republicans, who just simply put a block on it. The Democrats tried to call them up and get passage by unanimous consent. One Republican blocked. That's all it takes. And so neither of those bills are going anywhere anytime soon.
Okay, but let's talk about the sweeping bill for a second that was killed today. And that one would really strengthen the actual act of voting, these paper ballots. This is something that Democrats have wanted for a while. Why do Republicans not want that?
So for one thing, Republicans have resisted taking cues from the president, taking up some election security bills, because President Donald Trump has repeatedly signaled that any kind of legislation that is on election security is some kind of an affront to his election in 2016, because he does not like the idea that he was somehow helped being elected by Russian interference. So that's part one. Part two is that the policy side, there are some disputes about from Republicans about how much more federal government aid or direction is needed. In this case, they have said, we don't like the idea of the federal government giving directives here on this subject to the state and local government, because we think this is a state and local government issue. And of course, the Democrats say, we don't want to take over, but that is the way Republicans have characterized it.
And when we hear Robert Mueller say, as we just played, that this was not a single attempt, they're doing it as we sit here. I guess he's talking about the Russians. What is he talking about? What are they doing right now as we sit here when it comes to the next election?
So some of that is some things that he might be privy to that we aren't. But what we do know is that there have been attempts, for instance, online on Twitter to continue to manipulate and undermine our society's debates on social media. But, the idea that there will be election hacking attempts in 2020 is pretty commonly held by even Trump administration officials, that this is something that they're going to keep working at, that all indicators are that they were happy with the way it went in 2016. Therefore, they're going to keep trying. There did not seem to be quite as much of an attempt in 2018, but of course, that was a midterm election. There was no presidential race at stake. Trump wasn't on the ticket. All of the indicators were that the Russians wanted to help Trump. So it wasn't as much of an issue in 2018. But I think when he's saying, as we sit here, he means they're plotting, they're planning, they're going to be working on it, they're going to be trying to do what they can. Outside of the social media stuff, also into the hacking of other kinds of things.
Meaning voting systems?
So yes, there is a thought that, of course, you could try to hack the individual voting machines, although because hacking one machine wouldn't get you too far, it would take a pretty coordinated effort to do that. Another thing to think about is things like the voter registration rolls that are, somewhat online. If you could manipulate those, you could have a big impact. Or perhaps if you were able to get access to machines at the places where they're reset after each election, you might be able to affect them on a wide-scale way that way. But of course, another thing to think about is that if you look at one of the most successful things that they did during the previous presidential race, is that they hacked into the Democratic National Committee, they hacked into Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman's emails, and they leaked those. And then some of those were not flattering to the Democrats, and that helped sway some of the view toward Republicans and toward President Trump ultimately.
And it seems that everyone assumes that this is going to happen in 2020. And yet, is anybody proposing anything that could actually go to prevent this kind of, I guess, hacking, if you will, election hacking when it comes to like a disinformation campaign on social media or the spreading of these emails?
The disinformation part is among the harder parts, and that's saying a lot because, of course, our whole conversation so far has been about all the things that aren't happening. And no lawmakers I've talked to have had a good idea about how policymakers can address that problem.
Right. And so does that explain a little bit why it seems so difficult, there seems to be little appetite. I mean, you saw it yesterday in the hearings. It wasn't really talked about that much until the very end, but little appetite on both sides to do something broad and sweeping and actually enact it before the 2020 election.
The difficulty of it is part of it. I do think it does go more to the political disagreements and the policy disagreements. One thing that I think might be able to happen, if you look at the three major pieces that all election security experts agree on need to happen to have a real significant impact on election security in this upcoming election: mandating paper ballots, mandating post-election audits, and also money. Just making sure that these local and state election officials have enough cash to hire cybersecurity advisors, to pay for those paper ballot and post-election audit procedures. That is something that did get done right at the 2018 mark, at the beginning of 2018. $380 million got approved. Some amount of that has been spent. Republicans had been saying, let's wait and see how that money gets spent before we start spending more. But there have been recent attempts. And what that really reveals is that there might be some motion toward at least that money part.
All right, Tim Starks, he writes about cybersecurity for Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Russian meddling in our election. Sure sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's not. But then there's QAnon, Pizzagate, aliens. Why and how conspiracy theories flourish. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A man walks up to the home of a notorious New York City mob boss, tries to make a citizen's arrest, but ends up shooting and killing him. The man does this because he believes in a conspiracy that the political deep state is trying to undermine President Trump. Sounds a little crazy, right? A lot of crazy. But that is the real argument a lawyer is making in a real court on behalf of his client. This client is a QAnon believer who is facing a very real murder charge. QAnon is the theory that a government insider is dropping clues about how Trump is secretly battling an underground cabal of political and media elites. Well, that theory is the conspiracy theory du jour. To be sure, Americans have always had a taste for conspiracy theories. Today, though, they seem to be all over the place and seem to metastasize quicker. Here to explain why is Anna Merlin. She's the author of a new book called Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this isn't the first time that someone who believes in QAnon has done something, well, potentially violent.
Drastic.
In this case, drastic.
Yeah.
Tell us about this other case.
So there have been a couple of incidents where QAnon sort of spills over into real life. The most notorious one was last summer. A man named Matthew Wright drove his car out onto the middle of Hoover Dam with an assault rifle because he wanted to demand that the federal government release what he believed was the real Inspector General's report that would reveal that the Mueller investigation was, in fact, an investigation into Donald Trump's political opponents. So he was arrested on a rich variety of federal charges. But thankfully, in that instance, nobody was hurt.
Right. But in this case, this guy, Anthony Camello, killed this mob boss.
Yeah, his lawyer is arguing that he intended to make a citizen's arrest by showing up at this guy's house, ramming into his car, luring him outside, and then shooting him. So we'll see how that holds up in court.
Right. So I guess, you know, you could easily look at these people and go, well, they're just crazy and they're deluded. And that's very sad. But there have always been crazy and deluded people who are willing to engage in violent acts. Mm. Where does it cross over, though, the belief in these conspiracy theories and people who really are not crazy?
So we know that most Americans believe in at least one conspiracy theory. 50% of us are one in three, according to most studies. Most conspiracy theories that we believe in line up with our political beliefs, our economic background, our social background. But the idea of where it crosses over or intersects with people's delusions or active mental illness is really, really hotly contested. And it's really a difficult thing to diagnose, especially if you're not a clinician. So I try to stay away from it. But certainly that is the discussion that we've been having since Richard Hofstadter's essay about conspiracy theorists on the right in the 1960s, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, because Hofstadter drew a very strong link between mental illness and right-wing conspiracy theories that has since been complicated by some more, I would argue, sophisticated readings of what conspiracy theories are and what they do for us.
So is the conspiracy theory non-discriminating, if you will, when it comes to political beliefs?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're on the left and the right, and you're equally prone to believing in conspiracy theories.
Definitely. There are a lot of things we know about people who believe in conspiracy theories or are more prone to them. One thing that we know is that people who believe in conspiracy theories have lower levels of interpersonal trust. They have more pessimism about their own lives, what their own futures are going to look like. And they also, interestingly enough, a lot of people who are in the deeper end of the conspiracy pool tell researchers that they would be more likely to engage in a conspiracy themselves. So there's something about if you're willing to do it, you're more likely to believe that other people will do it. So it's this whole mess of competing sort of psychological and social factors.
Well, maybe we should back up and define what a conspiracy theory is, because if you're saying that most Americans believe in one, then they sound like they're pretty normal.
They're pretty, I don't know about normal, but common, certainly, right? So a conspiracy theory is, at its core, a belief that a small, secret, powerful group of people are working against the common good. And a conspiracy is when people are actually doing that. And so, especially in America, it can be very unclear what is a conspiracy theory and what is an actual conspiracy. And the gap between those two things is where all of this argument and discussion comes from about what is real and what is imagined.
Well, right. When you have instances that happened in our history that seem outlandish but ended up being true, like, let's say, the Tuskegee syphilis experiments.
Then
what are you supposed to believe when the official sources say this is not true?
Yeah, the United States especially, we have a lot of conspiracy theories about the federal government, and that's for a number of reasons. The conspiracy theories about the federal government really started growing after World War I because the size of the government grew and how opaque the government was became more and more sort of dense and severe. Also, you know, American conspiracy theories about the federal government are sort of a reflection of our natural inclination towards populism and questioning authority. So in a lot of ways, those conspiracy theories are just kind of an extension of our natural politics.
Is there one that you believe in?
Yeah, aliens.
What do you mean by aliens? Like little men with big eyes?
I think.
Or just life?
Well, I should preface this by saying that I'm from New Mexico, first of all, and secondly,
Helen Roswell.
Yes, and alien belief is one of the most common forms of conspiracy theory in the United States. So generally, when we talk about a belief in aliens, what we're talking about is a belief that statistically we're probably not alone in the universe. The math doesn't really add up there, and also that the government might be hiding what they know about research into alien visitation or alien visitation itself. I would be more likely to believe, because it's true, that the government has, for a period of decades, hidden their own research into the search for extraterrestrials, UFOs, alien life, because we know this to be true, because a secret Department of Defense program was revealed at the end of 2017 that was, in fact, a hidden program searching for aliens and alien technology.
Right.
A lot of conspiracy theories about the federal government end up being much more sort of prosaic arguments for greater government transparency, which is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting also that a lot of these conspiracy theories are at their core anti-Semitic.
Yes, they are.
And that is because why?
Anti-Semitic conspiracy theories are some of the oldest conspiracy theories there are. And they are not like other conspiracy theories about questioning power or questioning the government or officialdom in general. Anti-Semitic conspiracy theories are part of an older group of conspiracy theories that are fundamentally about xenophobia, a fear of outside influence, a fear of outsiders taking over. And so Jews have been particularly susceptible to being the subject of those conspiracy theories because they were a stateless people. And so conspiracy theories about Jews harken back to the literal Middle Ages, when there was a belief that Jews were kidnapping Christian children to murder them and use their blood in matzah, a belief called the blood libel that still persists in some parts of the world today. I've had white supremacists and neo-Nazis repeat that belief to me in utter sincerity.
Really?
Yeah.
That they're going to use the blood in the matzah?
Yeah, there is definitely a belief that if there is a global cabal murdering children, that Jews are at its heart. I should mention here that I'm Jewish, which is always an interesting thing to bring up when I'm having those conversations with people who believe in the blood libel.
Yeah. But I mean, these are people who in other walks of life would pass as sane. And when you say that this just sounds absurd on the face of it, they say what?
It sort of depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about white supremacists and neo-Nazis, you know, they're not going to view me as a reliable source of information about what's true and what isn't. You know, when we get into a discussion about how the blood libel is not real and the Holocaust really did happen, you know, things of that nature, they're not going to believe me because I am obviously in their eyes part of the global cabal, which is points to another thing about conspiracy theories, is that if you want to debunk a conspiracy theory to someone, if you want to talk them out of it, the research shows that they have to be a recent convert and that you have to sort of be like them. They have to view you as their counterpart sort of politically, economically, socially. So if you're seen as an other, it's going to be very hard to sort of dissuade them from a belief.
I wonder if all of this talk of the Russian influence in the campaign and Cambridge Analytica and Facebook and all of this stuff only fans the fires when it comes to believing in conspiracy theories. Because if you were dropped in from another planet, let's say you're an alien, and you visit Earth and you hear this, you would think, and you weren't prone to believing in conspiracy theories, you think, well, that doesn't sound, that sounds absurd.
Right.
And yet it's not.
Yeah. And this is something that comes up in American life and American politics a lot. In the 1970s, there was a government action called the Church Committee that was an investigation into what the FBI had been up to for the past couple decades as far as disrupting civil rights groups and trying to actively destroy the civil rights movement. And one thing that came out of those hearings was not just an understanding that the FBI was engaged in tactics that were meant to destroy the civil rights movement,
but the COINTELPRO program.
COINTELPRO, but a belief that perhaps anything was possible. This happens a lot in the United States, is when real conspiracies are eventually uncovered, they do, as you say, feed people's belief in conspiracy theory.
Anna Merlin, she's author of the new book, Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how 60 Minutes star reporter Mike Wallace changed broadcast news.
Before Mike, it was all Edward Morrow, Severide, Cronkite. Great journalists, but very dry, very boring.
The director of the new documentary, Mike Wallace, is here himself, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Wally Safer.
I'm Harry Reasoner.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Diane Sawyer. Those stories and more tonight on 60 Minutes.
There probably would not have been 60 Minutes without Mike Wallace. He began the program back in 1968 with Don Hewitt and made his and the program's reputation by asking anyone who was anyone tough questions. It was a skill he developed early in his 70-year career.
Mrs. Roosevelt, I think that you will agree that a good many people hated your husband. They even hated you.
Oh, yes.
Secret slush funds. Laundering money in Mexico. Payoffs to silence witnesses. Perjury. Conspiracy to obstruct justice. All of this by the law and order administration of Richard Nixon.
Is there a question in there somewhere?
You're in your late 30s. You got 40 years to live. Minimal.
Well, I hope you're right about that.
What are you going to do?
There are a lot of things to do. You know, a fertile imagination and a good fertile mind, Mike, it's really amazing what can be thought of. There are so many things to do.
Politics?
No, not politics.
All right, Donald Trump there back in the 1980s. Before that, John Ehrlichman. And, of course, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. He also interviewed Salvador Dali, Barbara Streisand, Martin Luther King, Ayatollah Khomeini, Vladimir Putin, Oprah. It goes on and on. Well, Mike Wallace is the subject of a new documentary. It's called Mike Wallace is Here. And here in the studio with me is the director, Avi Belkin. Welcome.
Hey.
You're an Israeli.
I am.
Most of your movies in Hebrew.
Prior to this one and another series that's coming out pretty soon, yeah.
So what attracted you to Mike Wallace?
Well, so this movie started roughly 3 years ago, and back then I was still living in Tel Aviv, and I just finished working on my feature film in Israel, which was about the most infamous river in Israel, and it took me almost 4 years to do it, and when I finished it, I was broke, and the movie was kind of successful still, and I felt like I gotta get a bigger market, so I was looking for ideas to do in America. And this was before Trump got elected, but journalism was already very much in debate, the state of journalism. This was after Spotlight won the Oscar. And I asked myself, how did we get here? How did broadcast journalism find itself at that tipping point where, again, before Trump seemed to be a tipping point, now it's obviously kind of a worse situation. And every time I would bump into Mike Wallace clips, just interviewing this guy and that guy, and he was so charismatic and so engaging, I kind of felt like that's a character here for sure. And I started researching him, and I had this idea of doing a portrait of Mike and through it basically tell the broadcast journalism story. And I took a plane ticket to America, and here I am.
And that's it. And you didn't really know much about him before.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Just,
you had never seen
60
Minutes?
I knew who he was. Of course, I knew who he was, but I knew this tough guy persona, interviewer. That's it. Just like very surface level.
You open the documentary with a really interesting moment. It is him interviewing Bill O'Reilly.
You say you're a journalist.
Correct.
I say that you're an op-ed columnist, which is different.
No, it's not. You're a dinosaur.
You have to engage now. You have to challenge. You have to be so provocative.
This is going to embarrass you, Wallace. So are you ready to be embarrassed? Playboy magazine wrote that Bill O'Reilly is the most feared interviewer since Mike Wallace. You're the driving force behind my career.
That is pretty surprising to hear.
Yeah. It's funny not seeing the images, because in the images you see Mike swallowing, you know, and very uncomfortable with the comparison, obviously, and what O'Reilly is saying to him.
But then that really sets the stage for your movie, because, in fact, he was the Bill O'Reilly of his time. At least that's how he was seen by the quote-unquote real newsmen of the time.
He was definitely looked down upon when he came into journalism, and he didn't have the right credentials back then, etc. But there's something that's very interesting in the exchange between Wallace and O'Reilly, where Wallace calls him, you know, an opinion journalism, not really a journalist. And of course, O'Reilly retorts and says that you made me. And then Mike basically says, what you're doing is not an interview, it's a lecture. And I think that's the big separation between O'Reilly and Mike. Mike was all about the answers. He asked questions to get the answers. He was looking for the conversation. And O'Reilly is kind of looking to validate his opinions and to be heard in his opinions. And I think that's where they differ. In a way, O'Reilly maybe is a result of Mike's revolution, but he did take it, I think, in the wrong direction, in a different direction, because Mike was... he was a journalist. Yeah, he came into the business from the show business side. He was a pitchman before and did commercials, etc., and was looked down upon by the old journalists of the time. But his heart was in the right place. Mm. He still went after the story.
He went after the story, but he also went after the drama.
Yeah.
He liked the moment where he got his fish on the hook and the fish is squirming.
Yeah.
He really liked that. and he went for that. And because he not only did that in his one-on-one interviews, but then he was one of the early pioneers of those gotcha interviews where they went out in the street with a camera, chasing down some guy who didn't want to talk to them or barging in on them in the office and that kind of thing, which is very entertaining and dramatic, but I think can be taken out of context in many ways. And many journalists think that that's not exactly ethical to do that. But he did it anyway, ostensibly to get at the truth, to get someone to answer his questions. But in fact, many times they didn't, and it just made for good TV, good drama.
So I agree with everything you've said, but let me just put a little bit more context into it. Mike, in a way, came in the early days of television. Television changed the game for journalism. We got to remember that. Journalism had to compete for the viewer's attention. It had to be a little bit more lively. It had to add some drama and color added to it. And Mike, coming from an unorthodox background, was the perfect new journalist in a way, because he was an actor, because he knew how to perform in front of the camera. And Mike was the first to admit it. He did add a little drama, a little color to it. But again, as I watched the early 60 Minutes pieces, the early ones are amazing. They're really like spot on journalism. And then it became, 60 Minutes became this monster, right? So 68, when 60 Minutes began, news had no rating. News was this obscure thing that nobody wanted to watch. And when CBS decided to do this first ever news magazine, they were like, this is going to last maybe a year or so. Nobody's going to watch it. And indeed, for the first 3 years, nobody watched it. And then suddenly 60 Minutes started to gain recognition. The Watergate obviously broke out, and Vietnam was in the news, and people wanted news. And 60 Minutes was perfectly suited to hit that spot because it was entertaining as well, not just news. And that created a revolution. And in that revolution, everybody got a little drunk on that power. And obviously the movie kind of shows what happened afterwards in the years that followed.
There's a really interesting moment where he flies to Tehran to meet with the Ayatollah Khomeini during the hostage crisis.
Yeah.
And he goes off script. Khomeini demands that there be questions prepared and that he just stick to the script, but he goes off script. And he asks him about Anwar Sadat, president of Egypt.
Imam President Sadat of Egypt, a devoutly religious man, a Muslim, says that what you are doing now is, quote, a disgrace to Islam. And he calls you, Imam, forgive me, his words, not mine, a lunatic. I know that you have heard that comment.
I'm not sure if I can get the answer because this was not in the question.
Please ask him, I'm sure. It's a very simple, straightforward question. I heard that the Imam is a disgrace to Islam.
Yes.
And he used the word a lunatic.
And he tells that to Khomeini, and Khomeini says, well, he's basically a traitor to Islam, which gave license to fanatics to take him out, to assassinate Sadat, which is what happened. Do you think that there's a direct line from that Mike Wallace interview to the assassination of Anwar Sadat?
I think, in a way, this is a microcosm story of Mike. This story and that moment with the question. It shows the best of Mike and the worst of Mike in the same moment, right? Because a regular journalist, if specifically in that back then, would not even ask that question. Because the idea was that they had to submit all the questions in advance. So that question was unauthorized. It was not approved before. And we got to remember, we said that the situation, the setting, this is 1979. There are hostages like few buildings away. This is basically all out war almost. And Mike is sitting in that room isolated from his crew. This was the Iranian crew shooting it. And in that hostile environment, he still asked that question. He still put it there, which is amazing. And then we go to the other side of Mike, the second persona of Mike, which is part of the deal. And that making it dramatic, making it colorful. So he adds this lunatic into the thing and he makes it more flamboyant. So you can go and say, well, Mike is partially in charge and corporate in that Sadat assassination. But you can also say that would have happened anyway. And there was a fight between Sadat and Khomeini that not Mike started.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Khomeini knew that quote before Mike said it to him. It wasn't like it was the first time he ever heard it. And you see in the film, he's smiling like the Godfather. It's not like he's smiling like, yeah, the plans are already made. We're already in the final scene of this film almost, and we're going to assassinate him. So for me, again, it's complex. And Mike was just the right person at the right time, again, with the right quality to ask that question. Because I don't think a lot of journalists would ask that.
Yeah, because he could have been like added into the hostage.
Taken into the kidnaps, of course.
Yeah. Whatever. So was he ever afraid?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was afraid of himself. I think that's the interesting element of Mike's story. I think Mike was not a reflective person. He was afraid to look inwards. He used his interviews to reflect on himself, if I can say that. In a way, he has this beautiful quote that I love where he says that interviews are a way for us to learn about others, but basically learn on ourselves through others, through those conversations. And Mike, I always felt like that, and that's the way I kind of framed the film, was asking himself questions. It was basically, you know, you're an interviewer, obviously. You choose questions by your own subjects, your own themes. You know what I mean? Your subconscious is kind of clear in the questions you ask. And I think Mike, a lot of the time, asks people, what are you afraid of? Why are you working so hard? How many times you've been married? All of these questions are echoing through Mike's entire life. So I felt like, in a way, he was trying to gain perspective from his interviewees.
Yeah, and then when he is interviewed, he's very bristly at times.
Of course, he's getting the answer from them. He doesn't need to give another answer. He's already satisfied. But yeah, I mean, he's human. Nobody wants to answer the tough questions. That's what's made it so interesting to watch his interviews.
Well, I mean, that's as someone who is an interviewer,
I
can tell you it's a lot easier to ask questions than to answer them.
True, but a lot of people call Mike a hypocrite for that. I disagree on that, but again, like for me, it was just weak. It's a weakness. A lot of people have weaknesses. We're all human.
Mm-hmm.
And his weakness was the inability to reflect.
That's interesting because you do have a moment where he does decide for a second to reflect when he's in conversation with Morley Safer.
Mm-hmm.
And he really reflects
on it. It's called old age, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is, right? That he didn't feel like he had anything else to lose, so he could be honest finally about a very important event in his life.
I've never said this before. No, I tried. And Mary found me. I wrote a note, and Mary found it. And she found the pills that I was taking on the floor. I was asleep.
You got lucky.
Yes, I did get lucky. I don't know why the hell you asked me that question, because other people have, and I've, it's the first time I've answered it honestly.
How old is he there?
88.
Wow.
It's crazy. That's when he retired. He worked till he was 88.
So you got a lot of that footage from the special that they did for him.
Yeah,
leaving.
I got the raw footage of that special. Footage. Yeah, that special was a 42-minute, not so good of a show.
That was not in the special.
No. It was very short, like maybe like 10 seconds out of that exchange. And I think that Mike kind of gave that moment to Morley, because everybody asked Mike that question about the suicide. There was a story about it. Barbara Walters asked him, all the big journalists that interviewed him asked him, and he always denied it. And I think he gave that to Morley as really a sign of how much he appreciated him, even though they went back and forth with Fields all of their career.
Hmm. That's nice, though. So it's a gift, really, in a way.
I watched as much Mike Wallace as anybody ever watched, I think. He was a very complex person. There's no doubt about that. But he had a very, very soft side at the end of it as well.
Well, Avi Belkin, it's been a pleasure having you in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Avi Belkin, director of Mike Wallace, is here. It's in theaters tomorrow. Coming up, how the photographer Gordon Parks changed the life of a boy in Brazil, what that says about photography, poverty, and exploitation. Carolina Miranda is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In 1961, photographer Gordon Parks took an assignment from Life magazine to take pictures of South America's poorest neighborhoods. And while shooting in a Rio de Janeiro slum, Parks met a 12-year-old boy named Flavio da Silva. He took photos of the boy carrying giant buckets of water, feeding his infant siblings, and having violent asthma attacks. There was a huge response here in the U.S. People donated money. He was flown to this country for medical attention. An American family took him in. And then, of course, the backlash. That story and Parks' photos are the subject of a new exhibition at the Getty. Joining me now, Carolina Miranda. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, also comes on this show quite frequently. Hello.
Yes, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. All right, so this is called Gordon Parks, the Flavio story. And tell us about how this story came about, because the original assignment was not that, to photograph Flavio.
Yes. Well, bless Gordon Parks for ignoring the directives of his Life magazine editors. It was the late 1960s, early 1961. Life magazine set about doing this whole series of reports about poverty in Latin America. And there were all of these debates about how to do it. Do you take a tour of various countries and depict poverty in that way? Do you go to one place and portray it in depth? They settled on an assignment where he would go to Brazil. He would go to one of the favelas, the infamous slums of Rio de Janeiro, and he would follow a father as he went about his business. And the primary concern with Life story was not, you know, let's understand poverty, let's understand the systems of inequity that feed it. It was a very Cold War angle, which is, could this poverty breed communists? And this is, you know, an era in the United States where we're at like our maximum communist paranoia. It's post Bay of Pigs. And so Gordon Parks gets sent to Brazil, but rather than focusing his story on a father, he finds his son, Flavio da Silva, who ends up being this charismatic and tragic figure, and Parks spends 20 days shooting him in Rio de Janeiro.
Let's hear from Parks himself. Here he is talking about that assignment in a 1964 documentary.
I was sent to Brazil to do a story on poverty in general. So I found this little boy who was struggling up the hill with a bucket, 5-gallon bucket of water on his head. I was sitting underneath a Jacamindo tree or something of the sort, and he smiled at me. I smiled back at him. He was a beautiful kid, but death was all over him. I could see he was dying.
All right, so then tell us about some of the photos that he took. They're all in black and white, right?
Yes, they are all in black and white, and they depict life in the favela and sort of the structure of the favela, which was right under the famous statue of Rio's Cristo Redentore, the Christ with open arms. And it captured the daily life there, but also daily life for Flavio, which was, you know, a wood shack, no plumbing, no electricity, the sort of struggle forage for food. He's taking care of half a dozen siblings who are younger than him. He's barely 12 years old himself and in poor health. And the photos are truly remarkable. You see original prints at the Getty Museum. Gordon Parks had spent a good part of his career photographing poverty prior to this assignment in the United States. Some of his most famous images have to do with poverty, a series that he did for the Farm Services Administration during the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. He had done series on poverty in Harlem as well. So this was a subject that was near and dear to his heart. And he created this quite remarkable, quite beautiful, quite poignant portrait of this boy's very difficult life, which the Brazilian press did not like.
I see. Okay, well, here in the United States, there was, as I said, a huge response. And here is Gordon Parks in that same documentary talking about that.
And in came thousands and thousands and thousands of letters. In came, in less than 3 weeks, over $30,000. And Life magazine says, you got to go back and get that kid. And there was a Jewish clinic in Denver, Colorado, said if I brought him to them, they would save his life. The doctors in Rio said, this kid won't live another 6 months. I said, I'm going to take that chance. And what happened was that Flavio lived.
Wow. Okay. So Gordon Parks saves his life, basically. Is that the story?
Yes. He saves his life. But I think the question in retrospect is how his life was saved. Because I think what has come up again and again is this idea of a journalist sort of intervening in a subject's life and the effects that that can have. So he brings Flavio to the U.S. Flavio ends up spending 2 years in the United States, living in Denver, getting medical treatment, becoming healthy again. But, you know, this was a very sudden thing for a kid that had pretty much spent almost his entire life, not just in Rio de Janeiro, but in that literal favela. Like, mm-hmm. as part of his story, Parks takes the kids to the beach for the first time. They'd never even been to the beach in the city that they live in. So it's this kid that is yanked away from his family, ends up spending 2 years in Denver. Obviously, this is an alien culture, alien world. He acclimates to it, learns to speak English, makes friends, develops a crush on a girl in school. And at the end of his 2 years of treatment, he is forced to go back to Brazil with a future that is rather unclear. A family that, although their circumstances had been improved by the story because Life magazine bought them a house in a working class neighborhood, you know, they were still dealing with the effects of poverty. The mother and father mm-hmm. still worked a series of sort of hand-to-mouth jobs to survive. There was conflict. There were these kids to be taken care of. And so he gets sent back to Brazil, you know, with kind of out a clear plan of what would happen to him once he was there. Life magazine, a correspondent for Life magazine in Brazil, made arrangements to have him go to private school for a while in Sao Paulo. That worked for a little while. But, you know, without the resources and I think without the support to pursue another life, he ended up in that same sort of mill of poverty. But at the same time as this celebrated icon of the Gordon Parks story.
Right. And then when he gets back, maybe resented by his siblings and the other people in the favela. As you say, Brazil didn't take kindly to being portrayed this way.
Exactly. I think part of it was a lot of people, there was the question of the tone the story had taken, which they felt underestimated the nature of poverty in Latin America. There was also this feeling of like, hey, United States, you have poverty too, and you have problems too. And to come here and highlight ours completely overlook some of the problems that you have. You know, look in the mirror. It was this very sort of paternalistic mm-hmm. view of poverty in Latin America. And there was resentment towards Flavio. And I think there was also this question of like, okay, great, Life magazine readers, you've improved a lot of one favela dweller. Now, what are you going to do about the systemic issues of poverty that keep us living in slums? And there was a Brazilian magazine that, in response to this entire controversy, sent a photographer to New York to shoot a poor Puerto Rican family and depict conditions of poverty in New York City.
Okay, very quickly, we have 30 seconds or so. The Getty also has news that it has now the archives of Ebony and Jet magazines.
Yes, that was a huge thing because the question of what would happen to those archives after the bankruptcy was looming large. This is a historic trove of photographs, and part of them are coming to LA.
Exciting, exciting. Okay, all that happening at the Getty. Carolina Miranda, writer of the Culture High and Low column for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that will do it for us today at Press Play. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.